Hari Om Sahana Vavatu Sahana Bhunaktu Sahaviryam Karavavahai Tejasvinavaditamastu Mavidvishavahai Om Shanti 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 Jaya Shri Krishna Chaitanya Prabhu Nityananda Shri Advaita Gadadhara Shiva Sari Gaura Bhakta Vrinda Hare Krishna Hare Krishna 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 Hare 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 Rama Hare Rama 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 Hare Hare
So on reflectionism, according to the second view held by Vachaspati Misra, perception is a process of one-sided reflection. There is reflection of the self in the intellect, but there is no reflection of the intellect back into the self. He maintains that an object comes into contact with the senses, that is, impression reaches the mind, that is transmitted to the intellect, and that the intellect then becomes modified by the form of that object. It is at this stage that the ever-radiating light of the self illuminates the clear subject mirror of the intellect, which reflects the same light onto the object. The intellect then experiences the object as if the intellect were a conscious being. The intellect is just like a mirror that reflects the light of a lamp, and itself becomes capable of illuminating other objects as well. This means that the intellect, but not the self, experiences the pain, pleasure, or neutrality of worldly objects. While according to Vijnana Bhikshu, the pleasure, pain, and indifference are experienced by the self because the self and the intellect are reflecting each other. So here the difference is that, so we can see is that this Vachaspati Misra, he's saying it's only one-sided because the self, being above everything, cannot be actually experiencing all these things. That's his idea, since their ultimate goal in this whole philosophy is to get to the point of, the impersonal realization. So in that state, then you wouldn't be involved. So then he's taking it from here. You're not involved. So actually, you would be an illusion thinking you are involved, that you are. No, it's the intellect that is experiencing the pleasure and pain, not you, right? So it makes it a very easy step. But the Vijnana Bhikshu, which is also accepted by Vyas, then it makes the thing is that it's both ways. Because otherwise it's the Mayavad idea that it's only one way, this reflection. Right? Just like the senses and all that, the objects of the senses and that, the mind enters them, but they also enter the mind. It goes both ways. This is there in the Vedic psychology. Is that you see something, and that by seeing it, so then the mind is entering it. But at the same time, as it enters the mind, because the mind becomes attracted to it and attached to it. So it goes both ways. So then we see is that when Devahuti prays, and also the four Kumaras ask a question, they want to know, when can you separate this process so that the mind does not enter the sense objects? So then Krishna basically points out that this is not a very useful question because it's not something that's possible. You know, it'd be like saying, you know, when's the moon going to turn into Swiss cheese and when is the, you know, like that. So it's not going to happen. It's not a useful question. So the impersonalists, their idea is you're going to separate the mind and the senses. And then when you separate that, then you'll actually be situated properly in Brahman. Right? That's what makes, that is their philosophy. So you can see here is this opening here is he's taking it already, they're separated, they aren't connected, but you are thinking that they're connected. So this has much more the obvious element of the impersonalist philosophy to it. So the point is that the mind is always connected with the sense objects. The problem is not that it's connected to the sense objects. The problem is that we're attached to the sense objects, not in connection with the Lord. So we see everything in connection with the Lord, there's no problem. Right? Because the point is senses and sense objects, they always interact. We have a mind, it's going to be interactive. So that's the principle of being a conscious living entity. The difficulty is that we're interacting with the sense objects without connecting to the Supreme Lord. That's the problem. So anxiety becomes because of that. They take it that just because it's interacting, there's a problem. Because they're interacting with inferior subject, right? They're interacting with the material energy. So naturally, due to its temporary nature in that, it is going to be not satisfying, right? So therefore, you can say, yes, the senses and the sense objects, that interaction, the mind being involved in that, then there is pain, right? So pain, pleasure, and indifference. These are going to happen. So all this emotional element is going to not create a peaceful situation. But that's not, so the mistake is made. It's true that it is creating problem. But it's not true. It's because the mind and the senses are interacting. The fact is that they're interacting on the mundane platform. If the mind and senses are interacting on the spiritual platform in connection with Krishna, then that does not give any pain. That's not a problem. We understand the principle here? So the mistake comes is that it's interacting with the material world. No, it's interacting not connected to Krishna. So because they don't understand this, all they're left with is that interaction means mundane, so that means pain, so that means you want to get rid of it. Right? So then the difference is, Vijnana Bhikshu, then he is accepting that the senses and the sense objects and the mind, intelligence, all these are all interactive together, and the soul, therefore, because of his identification with it, is suffering. Right? So then you have to make that conscious, take that extra step. Vachaspati Misra, he's saying that actually it's not going on. It's actually an illusion that you think that you're suffering. It's not. Just the material energy itself interacting with itself is suffering. Right? But if that's true, how does dead matter suffer? Right? So that's why that opinion is not accepted by Vyasa. Both of these views are possible within the major theory of reflectionism, because the self's experience of external objects, or pain or pleasure, depends on the intensity of its identification with the intellect. One-sided reflection and reciprocal reflection are both valid views, because whatever comes to the intellect is experienced by the self. A self-created state of oneness between the self and the intellect exists, but if the identification is loosened a bit, then the consciousness radiating from the self allows the intellect to appear as though it were conscious. And thus the intellect experiences the external object. The more the identification is loosened, the more the intellect experiences, and the more the self watches the experiencing intellect as a witness. Right? So he's basically pointing out that both of them are correct, because if you're freeing yourself from the process, it's going to go in that direction anyway. But it's depending upon your freeing yourself from the process. Vachaspati Misra is saying that it's like that anyway. It's just a matter of understanding it. It means in one-sided reflectionism. In two-sided reflectionism, then that means you're having to actually make that commitment and endeavor to pull yourself out of that. Does this make sense? Right. Shankya recognizes two kinds of perception: indeterminate and determinate. The first is called alochana, which means merely seeing the object. So that's indeterminate. It arises at the moment of contact between the senses and the object, and is antecedent to all mental analysis and synthesis of the sensory data. In this state, there is recognition of the object as merely something, without any recognition of it as a specific object. Determinate perception, in contrast, is the result of the analysis, synthesis, and interpretation of sensory data by the mind. This type of perception is called vivechana, meaning interpretation of the object. Because it is the determinate cognition of an object as a particular identifiable thing, right? So in other words, the sense comes in contact with the sense object, and so there is interaction. So the let's say it's, we're seeing. The eyes are seeing an object. So seeing is going on, but it's indeterminate because you haven't identified what it is you're seeing. Does that make sense? You're seeing something, but it's not identified. So in other words, no, it's just the sense and the sense object interacting. Right? So that is indeterminate, or alochana. So, but then in the vivechana, that means then the mind has digested it, it's gone through the intellect, that whole experience has been, the process of analyzation and identifying what the thing is, then is the next state, right? So before that we were discussing, having identified it, then what is your experience of it? So in here it appears that they're not specifically taking into consideration the experience, right? Someone, the experience of it is what the soul is interested in, but here it's just a matter, you're seeing it, but nothing has happened, right? And then you analyze it and then interpret it. So you think this is good or bad or this or that, that kind of thing. Okay, so that will bring us to, that was pratyaksha. Okay, how you direct perception. Okay, so that was the analysis of there. So it has these two aspects of it. Okay, is the reflectionism that we just dealt with. One-sided or the reciprocal reflection, and then this aspect of perception being indeterminate and determinate, right? Inference. So knowledge derived through the universe or invariable relationship between two things is called anuman. Right? Remember, as before, we were basing it when we were dealing with nyaya. That a relationship, a universal relationship, something that's always there, then you can establish anuman. Right? Anuman has to be, otherwise if it's not based on that, then it's faulty. It's not real anuman. Right? It's not real inference. If it's variable, it's not anuman. Right? So there has to be some kind of aspect that it's always there. Ideally, it's that you have, object A and, let's see here. So you're trying to figure out means you have object A, you can see object A. Object B, you can perceive. But you cannot perceive object C. So now so A and B are connected. Now if you can establish that B and C are always connected, then you can say A is connected to C. Does that make sense? No?
Yes.
So, but the point is B and C, it has to be something that they are connected. If you make it up or just say they are, then that's not a bona fide process of logic. Right? You think they are, or they should be, or you would like them to be. That's not enough. That's like the modern theories, is that people feel like it. Yes.
So in that theory, what establishes that B is connected to C invariably? It's Shastra or it's common sense?
Basically, it should be Shastra, like that. But it has to be something that is perceivable. So that it doesn't go on infinite regression, so therefore Shastra is your natural form that will establish it. But it's just like the example is given as of smoke and fire. So smoke is always connected to fire. Right? But fire can be there without smoke. Right? So B is always connected to C in this case. Right? Because you have the hill and you have smoke. So B is connected to C, but C is not necessarily always connected to B. But since B is there, that means C exists. Right? So it has to be, one way or the other. Right? It's either, ideally, it's both are connected to each other, that's your most solid. Because then in any case, you can always prove it. If one is connected in one direction, but not in the other, then as long as it's in the direction of concern, then it works. If it's in the opposite, then, you know, if there's a hill and there's fire, you can't say, well, then there's smoke. There may be, there may not be. But if you see smoke, you can definitely say there's fire, because smoke and fire are always connected. Right? And then if B and C aren't connected, then you don't have logic. Right? You know, there's a smoke on the hill, therefore the hill must be covered with lollipops. You know, that would be faulty logic, because what does smoke and lollipops got to do with each other? Right? So, therefore, it won't work.
In the observance of the external world, this may be very, you know, but when they deal with the subtle, then they have to go to Shastra, right? To establish that, you know, C is always going to be.
Yes, there, but it's also something that may be accepted. So there's a whole list of things that, how it would be acceptable. But at this time, I wouldn't be able to say, because we dealt with that some weeks back, so it's fine points. But the point is here, the point is it's universal or invariable relationship. That's anuman, right? That's inference. It means one is there, the other is there. So therefore, you can say that there's a connection. Right? Like that. So that's how you can infer, because they are connected. Therefore, you can infer it. They're not connected, you can't infer it. So that's why it's dependent upon this universal connection, this relationship. The Shankya concept of inference is slightly different from that held by Nyaya philosophy. Right? So Nyaya is saying that that's what it is. Now Shankya is coming up with something different here. In Shankya, inference is of two kinds, vita and avita. Vita is based on a universal affirmative proposition, and avita is based on a universal negative proposition. Right? And avita is based on... Okay. Vita, positive inference, is of two types. Purvavat and Samanya Todrishta. It's never just so easy. You have this and that. It's like you have this and that. And then this has two parts. And this has two parts. And that one of that. And this one has two parts. And that has three. You know, that's the problem with all these systems, right? Okay. Now, in positive interest, purvavat and samanya todrishta. So purvavat, within the positive, within vita, is based on previously observed uniform concomitance between two things. For example, one can infer the existence of fire from the existence of smoke, because one has already observed that smoke is always accompanied by fire. Right? So it's observed here. So it does not necessarily has to be Shastric. The point is it has to be a position that you've observed and others are going to accept. If they don't accept it, what's the use of presenting it? Right? Samanya todrishta. Inference is not based on any previously observed concomitance between the middle and the major terms. Right? The minor is the situation. Then the middle, the major is what you're trying to infer. The middle, the major is, so the middle is what connects the minor and the major. Right? You have a hill, you have smoke. So the hill is the minor, the smoke is the middle, and the fire is the major. So you're trying to connect fire and the hill. So that's the minor and the major. Right? Because Nyaya is a system. They made it into philosophy, but Nyaya is a system. So it's accepted as a system. So that's why the same terms will be used. Okay, see the Nyaya chapter for an explanation of the terms of inference. This type of inference does, however, require facts that are uniformly related to the middle and major terms. For example, how can we know that we have senses? One cannot perceive his senses because they are beyond his own reach. So one must accept the existence of the senses by inference. Their existence can be inferred in the following way. For all actions, some kind of instrument is needed. Seeing, hearing, smelling, tasting, and touching are actions that must have their corresponding instruments. The senses are these instruments. Okay? In other words, something that can't be perceived, but you can get at them because there's a connection there. But you haven't seen them. In other words, one is something you can perceive, the other is what you can't perceive. But in both of them, we see that this universal relationship has to be there. Right? So that would be the difference. So both of those are positive, right? but one purvavat is previously observed, and samanyatodrishta is you can't observe it. But the relationship is there, so you can establish it. So it's still the nyaya you can apply. Now, negative inference. Negative inference, avita, is explained in the nyaya system as sheshavat, in which an inference results by the elimination of all other possible alternatives. For example, a certain whole number is inferred to be two because it has been determined that it is not three or more, nor is it one or less. Yet it is a certain positive integer. Therefore, it is two. Right? So that's, does that make sense? So in other words, from the negative, it can't be this and it can't be that, so it only leaves this one. Like that. So you're inferring that that is the one. Okay. Testimony. Shabda is the third source of valid knowledge. Shankya holds the same view of Shabda as Nyaya. And so the readers refer to the discussion of this subject in the chapter on Nyaya. All right, so in other words, Shabda means it has to be established by authority. Like that. So then, but they only accept these three. So they're not accepting that fourth one, that Nyaya is there, of that it's somehow or another connected. The concept of liberation. According to Shankya philosophy, the universe is full of pain and misery, and even what is thought of as pleasure is mingled with sorrow, because all pleasures ultimately end in disappointment, which is the basis of misery. It is the natural inclination of all living beings to rid themselves of pain and misery. But Shankya states that this can be achieved only through the correct discriminative knowledge of reality. Okay, testimony. Shabda, or testimony, literally means words. It is the knowledge of objects derived from words or sentences, and is, according to Nyaya, the fourth and final source of valid experiential knowledge. So we don't accept this third one. But, okay. Not all verbal knowledge, however, is valid. In Nyaya philosophy, Shabda is defined as the statement of an apta, a person who speaks and acts the way he thinks. Such a person's mind, action, and speech are in perfect harmony, and he is therefore accepted as an authority. Right? So it's not just anybody's testimony is Shabda. It has to be someone who, you know, their body, mind, and words, they're in balance, harmony. So it has to be a Mahatma. Thus, his verbal or written statement is considered to be a valid source of knowledge. The Veda is considered to be the expression of certain venerable aptas, great sages who realized the truth within and who transmitted their experiences into words. The validity of the Veda is derived from the authority of these aptas. So here we see is because they are not so worried about God in these philosophies, they're not saying it's authority because it's come down from God. They're saying it's authority because it's come from great personalities. Yes.
So basically, it means they accept the authority of tradition?
They accept the authority of the Veda and tradition. But in the Vedas are all conversations with great personalities anyway. So therefore, then, even if you don't accept God, they accept these great persons. So in either way, the Shastra is validated. But because their point is not to establish a relationship with God, so therefore they don't go that far in viewing something. You know what I'm saying? Like that. You know, it's just like the goat. The goat is, goat's interest is eating the leaves, the banyan leaves that are hanging there. They don't look beyond that to notice 3 more feet later is the butcher. Like that. They're only interested in the leaves, so they don't bother with what's beyond that. You know? So it's like that. They only see how much they want in accordance with the philosophy.
So that's how they catch a goat?
No, well, that's after they're already caught. They just keep them there and it keeps them happy. somehow or another. They're pretty dull in that way, the goats. They're clever in the way of, you know, climbing up, you know, sides of things and that, but they're not very smart when it comes to this side of stuff. The validity of verbal knowledge depends upon two conditions. First, the meaning of the statement must be perfectly understood. Second, the statement must be the expression of a trustworthy person, that is, apta, right? So this is very important because it's shastra, that's not enough. So it means we're dealing from shastra or whatever is our place of getting authoritative knowledge. So this could also mean you have an advanced personality or a qualified Brahman, they're giving you knowledge, they're apta. So then what they're saying would be accepted because they're naturally going to base it on the shastra itself. So that way things coming down in the parampara would be valid. Now, but the first condition is that you understand it. Because if you don't understand it, you can't apply it. So just to say, oh, Prabhupada said this, if you don't understand it, then it's not actually Shabda. You can say, I'm quoting the Shastra, but it's not complete because what, you know, the Shastra itself, what Prabhupada said, that's all apta, so that's fine. But you haven't understood it, so therefore your quoting of it technically is not counted as Shabda. You understand? So that's, so when somebody says something, then you can either discuss the point so that they understand from the point, or approach that, do they actually understand what this means? You know what I'm saying? Either way, because if they're not understanding what they're saying, so it can be pointed out in one of two ways. Directly, just you're not understanding what it says and then trying to explain it. You might deal with some false ego there. The other way is to approach it. So, okay, so you say Prabhupada says that. Well, what does he mean by this? What does he mean by that? Give examples. Explain it. Why? How do you define this word? Then you'll find, then they'll understand they don't know what they're talking about. Right? So, therefore, both of those things have to be. There are two main ways of classifying Shabda. The first method, okay, so that was, you had two conditions, right? So now there's ways of classifying. The first method of classifying divides testimonial knowledge into two categories. Okay, so here is, you have two methods, and the first one divides it into two. Sometimes there's always this two, and each one divides into two. That seems to be pretty standard in analytical studies. Okay, the first method of classification divides testimonial knowledge into two categories based on the nature of the object of knowledge, right? So now it's on the object of the knowledge. The first category consists of the trustworthy assertions of ordinary persons, saints, sages, and scriptures on matters related to the perceptible objects of the world. Examples of the evidence given by expert witnesses in court, the statements of reliable physicians about physiology, and scriptural declarations concerning the performance of certain rites. Okay, so this is by trustworthy assertions of persons who... Yeah, okay. The second type consists of the trustworthy assertions of persons, saints, sages and scriptures on matters concerning the supersensible realities. Examples are a physician's assertion about atoms, a nutritionist's statements regarding vitamins, a prophet's instructions on virtue, and scriptural statements about God and immortality. The second way of okay, so that means then this first, then it is the nature of the object. So the object is able to be established that is observable by persons who are qualified, right? Persons who are qualified are establishing something that's observable. The second is qualified persons are establishing something that is not perceivable, right? But both of them are considered shabda. So this is the first method of classification on objects of knowledge. Okay. The second type consists of the trustworthy assertions of saints, sages, and scriptures. Oh, no, that we did. The second way of classifying Shabda is based on the nature of the source of the knowledge. Right. Okay, so that's the nature of the object of knowledge, and now is the source of the knowledge. Right? So, in other words, we're talking about the object itself. Either it's directly perceivable or not. You know, but that's our basis of the other. The other is the source of this knowledge. This method categorizes all testimony as being either scriptural or secular. Here the word scriptural refers only to the sacred writings related to the Veda and the Veda itself. The words of scriptural testimony are considered to be perfect and infallible. Secular shabda is the testimony of fallible human beings and therefore may be either true or false. Secular testimony that comes from a trustworthy person is valid, but the rest is not. In other words, if it's secular knowledge from an apta, then it's valid. If it's not coming from an apta, it's not going to be valid. It won't be. The Nyaya system gives a detailed description of the nature of shabda because testimony is considered to be a valid source of knowledge and should therefore be analyzed thoroughly. In a scripture or a testimony, words and sentences are used. But what is a sentence? What is a word? And what is the nature of their construction? Here, a sentence may be viewed as a group of words arranged in a certain manner, and a word as a group of letters or phonemes arranged in a specific order. The essential nature of any word lies in its meaning, and there must be specific rules governing the arrangement of words in the formation of sentences. Without such rules, the words spoken, even by a trustworthy person, an apta, could be reordered to convey a different meaning from the one intended, or could mislead a common person because of the lack of clarity of meaning. In other words, sense, the shabda is going to come through words. Then there has to be rules governing how those words work, what they mean. How is the grammatical usage of the words? Because otherwise someone can take it and move it around. Right? If there is no rule on the word, you can take the letters and move them around and make a different word. And so what's to keep you from doing that? You can say, well, it's the same letters. You know, who said they have to be in that order? You know? Just like, what is it? Mark Twain said, he was saying about the attempts, you know, the modern attempt of trying to categorize, you know, a specific way of spelling a word. He was saying, this is because they have no imagination. Right? So they can't think of different ways. Otherwise, you know, there's so many ways you could spell a word. Right. Like you say, like, try. You could see T-R-A-A-Y, T-R-A-Y, T-R-I, or T-R-Y. All of those, they all say this. They all have the phoneme is the same, you know, in the way of the sound, like that. So. Therefore, when he would write, he'd sometimes use one way, sometimes another. So, but so here, the Nyaya is saying there should be a set way of doing things. Otherwise, someone will come up. So that's what word jugglery is you take it, and by grammatical rules, you adjust it around, and you come up with a different meaning. So that was what was so amazing to scholars in India of all sampradayas, is Jiva Goswami's Sanskrit. Take whatever rule you want, juggle it around however you want, and you still come up with the same meaning. You can never get a second meaning out of Jiva Goswami's statements. Right? And there's no other scholar in India that has ever done such a thing. None of the acharyas, none of the great Sanskritists, no one has ever understood Sanskrit grammar to that degree that when they write, you cannot get a second meaning out of it. What he says is what is all you can get out of it. So that's why you see, you know, you never see great scholars, you know, opposing scholars ever make any comments on Jiva Goswami. They just don't. They'll comment on Ramanuja, Madhva, this one, but they won't comment on Jiva. Why? Because there's no use.
Is it that some sastras, I believe I heard this, that some sastras are composed in such a way that if any syllable is changed, then the flow of the Sanskrit doesn't go so well, so therefore you can't change the meaning. So if that's true, then is this what Shankaracharya did to the Vedanta Sutra to make it seem impersonal, to reach an impersonal conclusion?
You break the words in a different place. See, the sutras are there. There's a certain number of sutras. I mean, there's a certain number, you could say, of words in the Vedanta Sutra that everybody accepts. How they break those words up, that's where the difference comes. Like that. Because you get anywhere from... We count 555. Like that. But some go up into the 560, 580. So they'll take bigger sutras, count as two, take smaller sutras, put them together. You break them in different places like this. So there'll be a difference this way. So by breakage, then they'll come up with different. Shankaracharya also didn't comment on every verse. He only found verses that were easy enough to juggle. Then in there, he would give that impersonal interpretation. And he would say, then like this, you interpret the others. Right? He doesn't do, but the Vaishnavacharyas, each and every sutra, they give a commentary. He doesn't do that. Because he can't. Right? Some of them, is just, they're too obviously personal. So he just does those other ones, and then, you know, it keeps them busy, because then they think, like this, I mean, I'm so smart, yes, I can also do like Shankaracharya did. But that's why he doesn't touch Bhagavatam, he doesn't touch these other works. So, but they're so foolish, is it can't be done, that's why Shankaracharya didn't do it. But they themselves think they can, so they go on and make commentaries and all these different things. So that was something. Okay. So in other words, then Shabda has to be, you know, it has to be proper in that. So what is there is it's coming from Shastra, and it is observable, or it is not observable, but it is established by the great personalities, like that. And what was the other one? Okay, and then there's secular, and then the Veda itself. So the Veda is always perfect, and then the secular is perfect if an apta is speaking it, right? And the other knowledge, then personalities can be done if it can be properly established. Okay, so that same Shabda is accepted by Shankya. Okay, now in liberation. The entire world and all internal phenomena belong to Prakriti. But pure consciousness, Purusha, is free from the limitations of space, time, and causation. Right? So now, space, time, and causation. So they're saying that the soul, there's no cause for the soul. So in one sense, you can say the soul is eternal. They've always been there. So it's not that he came into being. So Krishna establishes that. But it still doesn't mean that he's not part of the Lord's energies. So here in this, then they're ending, limiting Purusha to be just the jiva, and there's nothing beyond. Right? All activity, change, thought, feeling, pain, and pleasure belong to the body, mind, organism, not to the self. Right? So now we see they're separating that. The material energy, all that goes on there, because they're thinking, feeling, willing, it's all happening, but you're using the material mind, intelligence, and senses. Right? So then, in that case, since that's all the farther one is seeing, that would mean then that all, like they're saying here, all activity, change, thought, feeling, pain, and pleasure belong to the body, mind, not to the self, which is true. On the material platform. But that all these things can go on is because of the soul through the reflectionism. That's only because the soul by nature has its natural intelligence, mind, senses, and body that it functions with on the spiritual platform. Right? So the philosophy is very nice, very technical, up to a certain point, and then it stops. And where it's, because it stops, that's where things start to go wrong. Because they don't actually see it properly, because they don't see what's beyond. So if you only take part of a truth, then, you know, the basic principles are going to be fine, you know, with the actual bigger picture of the truth. But if you only take half the truth and you stop, you have to fill in the gap of that other half. So you have to make some adjustments. Right? There has to be some misidentification there, otherwise it won't work. Because you have to create something complete. The self is ever illuminated consciousness that transcends the entire phenomenal world, including the body-mind complex, which is true. So that's how they establish, therefore, it doesn't have any of these things. The self has a body, but the body is not the self. In the same way, the self has a mind, ego, and intellect, but it is quite distinct from all of these. Pleasure and pain, virtue and vice, merit and demerit,
orchestra, right?
Well, technically, they're all chanting Gauranga. It's just their way of saying Gauranga. Okay. Few diehards. Pleasure and pain, virtue and vice, merit and demerit, do not color the pure self. They color the intellect as it becomes involved with its surroundings. In other words, all these different things don't color, have any effect on the soul. They color the intellect, the mind, all these things. So that's therefore they become under the control of the modes. But the soul is beyond that, which we'll also agree with. But the problem is then they say that the soul basically has no qualities other than being conscious. All the experiences of the phenomenal world are received by Purusha because of its false identification with the mind, intellect, and ego. Right? So it means, in other words, all these things are happening within the intelligence and mind and senses. But because we identify with it, therefore we think we're experiencing it. Right? In one sense, yeah. So in that way you could say, yes, it is. There is no experience of it. But the thing is what's being experienced, as we explained from Bhagavatam, is actually the experience is the consciousness of the living entity coming in contact with the Lord and His potencies as they've entered into everything. Like that. So technically speaking, yes, the dead matter, there is no interaction. There isn't. So you identify with it, so you think that's what's giving you the pleasure and pain. But in any case, the soul is experiencing it. But from here, then they're thinking that it's not coming from the material platform. It's only because of false identification, which is true. But at the same time, the soul does experience. Right? Does that make sense? So that would mean it has to be the reciprocal reflectionism. It can't be the other one. And the one-sided. The one-sided is true is because actually what you are experiencing is the Lord. So you're pulling yourself out of matter, so you're not actually involved. It's not reflecting in you anymore. Does that make sense? Right, so you understand these fine points of where it's true but it's not, depending upon what perspective you use? Like that? The intellect is responsible for all experiences, but whatever Purusha ignorantly identifies itself with, but whenever Purusha ignorantly identifies itself with the intellect, it thinks it experiences as the intellect does. Even though Purusha is actually always and forever beyond the evolutes of Prakriti, which is true, but because of their identification, they suffer. It's just like you're seeing something. You're not experiencing the pleasure or pain of the other persons, but you can be affected by watching them. Right? Because you identify with it. You see someone sad, so then you become sad. But technically, you're not experiencing their sadness. But because you identify with it, then you understand? Like that. The manifestation of the universe into the 23 evolutes of Prakriti is not meant to create bondage for Purusha, but rather to help Purusha realize that it is free and distinct from Prakriti. Right? Not meant to create bondage. Although it may seem that external objects are meant for physical, mental, or internal enjoyment, that is not really the case because the mind, ego, and intellect do not function for themselves. They exist to provide experiences to Purusha. Feelings of pain and misery are experienced because Purusha falsely identifies with Raja and Tamas and forgets its capacity to see through its false identification. Thus, also Purusha fails to use Prakriti's sattvic manifestations as efficient instruments for discriminating the self from the non-self. The predominance of Raja and Tamas in the mind, ego, and intellect does not allow these instruments to filter external experiences properly. So Purusha receives unfiltered, contaminated experiences and ignorantly thinks it is suffering the pain and misery reflected by the intellect. Okay, so because you're dealing with the passion and ignorance, then and the soul is identifying with that, then it is experiencing the pleasures and pains of this world. Well, if it is situated in goodness, then it will see that it's separate from that and will not identify with it. Right? So somehow or another they're establishing that the Prakriti is not meant for to bind the living entity, but it's meant to show them how they are different from the material energy. But you can only do that if you're situated in goodness. If you're in passion or ignorance, then that won't happen. But that's not actually what the material world's for. It's not meant to bind you. It's supposed to show you that you don't belong here. You know, so this is true. But the problem is their conclusion after that is a problem. In other words, the mechanics of going through this is correct. But then the end result is not good because they don't take into it consideration of the Supreme Lord. Right. But otherwise, then it doesn't explain why all this would be going on in the first place. You know, that's the difficulty with their whole system. Shankya views Prakriti as a compassionate mother that provides everything to Purusha that he needs to understand his true nature, distinct from Prakriti, in her manifested and unmanifested states. Prakriti manifests herself out of compassion for Purusha, just as a mother's milk is produced out of compassion for her child. Unless it is somehow contaminated, the milk from the mother's breast is always helpful to the child. And likewise, the evolutes of Prakriti are helpful to Purusha, unless they are contaminated by the pradamans of Raja and Tamas, false identification, selfish action, possessiveness, or lack of discrimination. So it's interesting here is that compassionate this and that, but at the same time as we're saying that Prakriti is unconscious. Right, but when it comes in contact with Purusha, then by reflection it takes on the nature of consciousness. So then in taking on that nature of consciousness, then she becomes compassionate, and everything that she does in relation is actually for the benefit of the living entity.
So it allows them in their life to have that slight religious feeling which is natural for you.
Yes, because the point is that as humans then it's always natural to have those kind of feelings and that. So you can see is that technically it's actually part of, that means in one sense they're seeing consciousness and the soul are separate from material energy. So they're not, you can say as such purely materialism in the way of that consciousness and life has come from matter. But they can see is that as a person dealing in everything, so there's that respect there. But ultimately, they're jnanis, right? The point is to get out of the material world. So you can see there's always a mix. Then you bring out the personal. It makes it popular. Otherwise, how do you work with this? Right? It becomes too dry. So their point is then in dealing with the material energy, if everything's done in the mode of goodness, then there's actually not a problem. Because if you deal in the mode of goodness, that will create liberation. So that's the whole point, is that all the different variety that's there is so that you can deal with it in the mode of goodness, so that from that you will understand the difference between you and that, and therefore separate yourself from it. Right? But the mother doesn't feed the child and nourishes the child, so that, you know, the child will then one day just disappear, you know, because it's understood that it's, you know, it's not of this, you know. You know what I'm saying? That would be a little... So the example has its limits. like that. But because they're Purusha, they're the enjoyer, so they don't mind this. You know, if you don't mind a little bit of feminine support here because you have the Purusha Bhav, so.
And where's the mother coming from?
No, it's Prakriti.
Yeah, but I mean, you know, because you have a mother, she has a mother.
Oh, okay, yeah. No, but it's said that the material, they're not talking about that Prakriti, they don't say where it's come from. But they'll say that the manifestation of Prakriti is when the jiva comes in contact with it. So therefore, according to his interest, then everything manifests. Right? And so the whole point is that if you deal with it in the mode of goodness, then you can get out of it. If you don't deal in the mode of the goodness, then you're stuck. Like that. So, which is true, but it doesn't explain like that. Where does Prakriti come from? Where does the jiva come from? Why would all this be going on if you're not supposed to be involved anyway? What would cause the living entity to come in contact with? So these things so far haven't been explained. We're getting close to the end, so hopefully they'll explain it in the next four pages, and then okay. Okay. So now that explains, that finishes that. Now we'll go on to another point. So then we'll continue that. Let's do that.
Tuesday.
So on Thursday. Okay. Om Hare Krishna, Hare Krishna, Krishna Krishna, Hare Hare, Hare Rama, Hare Rama, Rama Rama, Hare Hare. Jai Srila Prabhupada ki, Samaveta Bhaktivedanta ki, Jai Nitai Gaura Premanandi.